Chapter 7 The Long Summer. We came to Baton Rouge after the Red River work was behind us, but not behind us in the body. A man may leave a campaign by steamboat and still carry it in his feet, his shoulders, and his sleep. The road from Alexandria, the bayous, the heat, the long column, and the nights broken by orders did not disappear because the river bore us south. They settled into us. We reached a place where the guns were not sounding every hour, and still a man listened as if they might begin again. Baton Rouge stood on the river with the look of a town held by war. It was not a battlefield when we came into it, and it was not peace. Union authority was there, with guards, offices, patrols, and the business of an occupied place. The river was the great fact beside it. Boats came and went. Men watched the landings for mail, orders, supplies, and rumor. The Mississippi carried more news than any road. A soldier learned to read the coming of a boat almost as he read the face of an officer. Something might be on it for the army. Something might be on it for him. We were put into the life of garrison, and garrison duty after a retreat has its own trial. It does not call upon a man to advance under fire, nor to stand in line waiting for cavalry to come in hard-pressed, nor to cross water in the dark with the enemy near the rear. It asks him to remain. It asks him to do the work set before him when the work seems small beside what he has lately survived. It asks him to keep his equipment in order, answer roll, drill, mount guard, take fatigue duty, wash, mend, write, wait, and begin again the next day. There was mercy in that, though we did not always feel it as mercy. We had some hours of work each day, enough to keep the soldier in us from going slack. Drill kept the body to its motions. Guard kept the eye and ear awake. Fatigue duty found the labor that armies always require, and men seldom praise. But the day wasn't filled from first light to dark with marching. There was time to clean ourselves and our clothing, and after the Red River roads that was no small thing. Dirt becomes a second garment in campaign. At Baton Rouge we could take ourselves to the river and wash on mornings when duty allowed. The water did not make a man new, but it took from him some part of the march. The heat governed everything. By mid-morning the air grew heavy enough that a man felt it as a hand upon him. The hours after that were not made for labor in the open. We learned the shape of the day around the sun. Work that had to be done was done. What could be avoided, waited. Men kept to tents or to the shelters we contrived from boughs and limbs, any green shade we could fasten into place against the glare. A soldier is taught to make do with little. In Louisiana summer, a few branches between a man and the sun could feel like a house. Under those shelters, time lengthened. Men wrote letters, read what papers could be found, cleaned muskets, mended clothing, slept with hats over their faces, talked of home, talked of generals, talked of what orders might come, and whether any officer knew more than the rest of us. Some men could sleep in heat that would keep another man in misery. Some lay with eyes open, too tired to move and too hot to rest. Flies found us. Dust found us. The river air came in damp, and still the sun burned through the hours. A camp in such weather teaches a man the small arts of preservation. He learns which side of the tent gives shade first, where the ground stays least foul, when to fill a canteen, how to keep a shirt from becoming another torment, how to save a little strength for guard when the day has already drawn strength from him. Men speak of courage as if it belongs only to the charge, but there is another courage in keeping oneself fit for duty through days that offer no glory. It is quieter, and because it is quieter, it is often overlooked. There was sickness in that country, and every man knew it. Fever, bowel complaint, the ague, and the general weakening that came from heat and water were never far away. A regiment could lose more by disease than by bullets, and the Department of the Gulf had already taught that lesson to many households. When a man looked at another's face in the morning, he looked not only for cheerfulness, but for signs of illness. The dull eye, the shaking hand, the skin drawn too tight over the bones. To be well enough to drill, wash, write, and complain was itself a kind of blessing. If the retreat had been a chapter of motion, Baton Rouge became a chapter of weather. The weather outside and the weather within were not separate. A hot day can make a thought heavy. A day without orders can make a rumor large. Men who have been delivered from danger may grow restless because deliverance has no clear employment. We were glad to be alive, and in a place the enemy did not trouble much. Yet gladness does not fill a whole day. Duty fills part of it. Habit fills part. Letters fill what nothing else can reach. The 13th Army Corps had been broken up in that season, and that news moved through the regiment as more than an alteration on paper. A corps is not only a line in the Army's order, it is the body in which men have marched and fought. The old corps had gone through Vicksburg before I joined the regiment, and the men who had been there carried that name with them. They had served under Grant, and had seen work that counted plainly in the war. To be shifted by order into another command was the Army's right, but it left the men uncertain. We heard that we were to belong elsewhere, and for a time even that seemed not settled in the minds of those who had to wait upon the order. The 19th Corps became the new name over us, but names at the top of the paper did not tell us where we would sleep next week. The question among the men was whether we would remain at Baton Rouge to guard the place or be sent again into movement. Soldier talk made much of it. One man had heard we would stay, another had heard we would go, another had it from a clerk, a teamster, a boat hand, or a man who knew a man at headquarters. Such reports travel quickly because they feed the one hunger. No ration can satisfy, the hunger to know what comes next. There was talk also of Colonel Guppy and a place of authority in the town. He had been sick in the Red River time, and sickness in that country was no light matter. The ague and fevers did the work of bullets in a slower fashion. To hear his name connected with Baton Rouge gave men something more to discuss. If the colonel had such a post, perhaps the regiment might remain. Perhaps the work would be garrison work for a while. Perhaps the summer would pass there. Every perhaps became a small shelter until the next rumor tore it down. The Confederates did not press Baton Rouge as they had pressed the retreat. Their cavalry could be near enough to make pickets useful and caution necessary, but the town was not under daily alarm. From time to time, our cavalry or pickets took men from the enemy's side, and prisoners came in with the hard, dusty look of irregular war. The country beyond our lines was not empty. It watched us. It carried word. It sheltered men who knew the roads and byways better than we did. Yet the days at Baton Rouge were not like the days below Alexandria, when the rear of the column seemed always in danger of being struck. Here the war came to us in pieces. It came in the newspapers. A soldier will read news with hunger, though he knows how often news is wrong. Papers came through the reading room and by the boats, handled by many hands before they reached us. They carried the great names of the war into our shaded places. Richmond was the chief name that summer. Grant was before it with the Army of the Potomac, and the hope among the men was that the pressure there might bring the whole rebellion down. We had seen enough of smaller campaigns to know that one place did not contain the whole war, yet Richmond stood in the mind as a door. If it opened, men believed much else must give way. The 4th of July sharpened that hope. For the country, it was Independence Day. For the men of the 23rd Wisconsin, it was also the anniversary of Vicksburg's surrender, the day their regiment had helped write before I was with them. I could not claim that memory as they could. I had not stood with them through that siege. Yet by July 1864, I belonged among men who had, and their memory became part of the air I breathed. A regiment carries its past like a family carries its dead and its honored names. The new man learns where the pride lies. On that fourth, the thought of Vicksburg and the thought of Richmond drew near each other. The date itself seemed to ask for another surrender. Men spoke as if Providence might set great events upon the same day to make the meaning plain. Whether God orders the calendar as men desire, I do not know. But I know the desire was there. The country had been at war more than 3 years. Every soldier in a hot garrison, every wife at a northern post office, every child learning to read while a father was away, had reason to ask that the end come soon. There was a difference between the talk of men who had seen Vicksburg and the talk of men who knew it only by report. The veterans did not need to make long speeches about it. They had the short confidence of men who had been present when a hard thing was accomplished. Grant's name carried weight with them because it was tied to results, not newspaper praise alone. I had joined after that great labor was done, but I could understand why they measured other commanders against him. A soldier wants to believe that what he suffers is being spent wisely. He can bear hardship better when he trusts the purpose behind it. The papers made Richmond sound near and far at once. One account could lift the camp, and another could make the same men doubtful before supper. We had learned not to give ourselves wholly to any single report, yet hope entered even when caution stood guard at the door. If Richmond should fall, men said, the rebellion could not long stand. That was camp judgment, newspaper judgment, and patriotic longing bound together. In the shade at Baton Rouge, with the river moving beside us and no great battle in front of us, the war in Virginia felt both distant and close enough to decide whether we might ever go home.
Looking back from the diary, Edward bound at 70, a young soldier is often ready to make a date bear more meaning than it can hold. We had seen the 4th of July marked once by Vicksburg, and it was natural that men should ask the day to carry Richmond also. Years taught me that the war did not obey our calendars. Still, I do not think the hope was foolish. Men far from home need signs. They need to believe that Providence has not left events loose in the world. If the date did not give us Richmond, it gave us a way to speak our longing for an end.
Mail day brought the war home in another fashion. The arrival of letters changed the camp more certainly than any editorial. Men watched for mail with a kind of guarded eagerness, because hope can hurt when it returns empty. I knew what it was to look for a letter and not receive one. I could imagine Janet going to the post office at Moundville, asking or waiting, and coming away with no word. I could imagine other wives doing the same. In camp we spoke of them, not as strangers, but as part of the same circle of waiting. The soldier waits for the home letter. The wife waits for the soldier letter. Between them the road is long and uncertain, and all love must travel through hands that do not know its weight. When one man received a letter, others gathered close. They did not mean harm by it. News from one home became news from a neighborhood. A name mentioned in Wisconsin could comfort 3 men in Louisiana. A word about crops, sickness, a birth, a death, a church meeting, a price at market, or a neighbor's errand could pass from hand to hand in speech, if not on paper. Men without letters listened more sharply than men with them. They wanted some portion of home, even if it belonged first to another man. Janet's letters brought me the farm as well as the family. I had left her with work no letter from me could truly lighten. Yet I wrote back about wheat, corn, rye, hogs, sheep, wool, hay, cattle, taxes, town orders, and whatever else could be managed at a distance by advice that might arrive too late. It is a strange thing to be a soldier in Louisiana and still try to be a farmer in Wisconsin. The hand holds a musket, but the mind measures a field. The body stands guard, but the thought goes to whether there will be feed enough for hogs when pork is dear. The army gives orders for the day. The farm asks questions for the winter. I wanted to know where the wheat had been put in, whether the sandy ground had suffered too much, whether the rain had come in time, how the sheep had sheared, whether the cows were doing well, whether the meadow would give hay, and whether the money owed for bounty had been treated as property by the assessor. These were not small matters to me. They were the substance of the home I hoped to return to. A farm left to a wife and her people in wartime is not an image of peace. It is labor, judgment, worry, and weather. Janet had to make decisions with children about her and uncertainty before her. I could only send words. Money had its own place in that worry. The bounty for enlistment was not an abstraction to us. It was part of the bargain by which a household endured the absence of a working man. If town orders were counted in one way, it meant one thing for the family. If counted in another, it meant something else. I had entered the army as a husband and father, not as a man free of obligations. Every dollar, every animal, every acre, every measure of feed belonged to the question of how Janet would carry the household until I returned. I trusted her judgment, but trust did not stop concern. A man far away may say what he thinks should be done, yet he knows the final choice will fall upon the one at home. Janet saw the animals, the weather, the children, the neighbors, the market, and the work with her own eyes. I saw them through her hand on the page. That hand made the distance both smaller and more painful. It brought the farm into camp, but it also reminded me that I could not step from the shade and put my own shoulder to the work. The children came into those words with a force no army matter could equal. Lizzie and James were learning, and that news gave me joy beyond the measure of a common report. A child learning to read is a household changing its future. If they learned good things while young, the teaching would stay with them. Sarah Ann and little Eddie were smaller, and my thoughts of them were more bodily. I could picture the weight of a child on the knee, the sound of a small voice, the singing that belongs to home and not to camp. Such thoughts could comfort and wound together. The same image that warmed me reminded me I was absent from it. There are fathers who speak of children in numbers because numbers are all the public record keeps. So many born, so many living, so many mouths to feed. But a father does not know them that way. Lizzie was not only the eldest girl. She carried the memory of the life I had before Janet and the sorrow that had made me a widower. James was not only a son at his lessons. He was a boy growing in my absence, old enough to be shaped by what he was taught and young enough still to need a father's hand. Sarah Ann and little Eddie belonged to the tenderest part of the household, where the work of a mother is constant and a father's absence is felt in the ordinary moments no army record can see. When I thought of Janet with them, I thought of more than affection. I thought of burden. A woman alone with children during war does not live in the sentimental picture men sometimes make of home. She rises to work. She answers questions. She manages food, clothing, neighbors, family illness, discipline, letters, money, animals, and the fear she may not speak fully because the children are near. If I asked her to kiss them for me or to give them a father's tenderness in my place, I was also asking her to do what I could not do. Love can be a comfort in a letter, but it can also lay another duty on the one who receives it. Still, those lines had to be sent. A child cannot live on a father's silence. If my arms could not reach them, my words must. If I could not sit in the room and make the little ones laugh, I could at least tell Janet what I wished done in my name. Such messages may seem small beside campaigns, but they were the thread by which the family remained one household across the distance.
From the other side of the letter, this is not Janet's preserved wording. It is the homeward silence the letter was trying to cross. In Wisconsin, the names were not tender ideas. They were children with hands, tempers, hunger, lessons, questions, and shoes to mend, Lizzie and James did not become easier to teach because their father wrote from Baton Rouge. Sarah Ann and little Eddie did not need less tending because the army had spared him. The farm did not wait because the war was large. Janet carried the names as work before she carried them as memory. A soldier's letter could ask for kisses to be given. It could send love over river, road, rail, and post office. But the receiving of that love was also labor. Someone had to read the words, fold the sheet, answer it, and then return to the children, the animals, the weather, the accounts, and the next meal. The war entered the house not with drums, but with absence.
What the record does not say. On a Sunday in Baton Rouge, the camp did not become quiet, but it changed its sound. The week had its noises, drill, guard mount, fatigue parties, axes, wagons, the calls of officers, the complaints of men under heat. Sunday held some of those, for an army cannot stop being an army. Yet there was a different expectation in the morning, as if men who had been handled by orders all week were allowed to remember another kind of command. I sat with the others where shade could be found. Some came because they loved the Lord. Some came because they loved home, and meeting was the road to it. Some came because there was nowhere better to sit. A hymn in a camp is not like a hymn in a church. It has fewer clean collars in it. It has muskets stacked nearby, and men whose hands are cracked, and flies that will not leave the face, and a river moving beyond the sound. But when the words rose, they crossed more ground than any regiment could march. I thought of Janet then, and of the children hearing scripture at home. I thought of little ones being taught before they could know how much their father depended on that teaching. In camp, faith did not remove the heat or shorten the war. It gave the day a shape that did not belong to the army alone. There were men around me whose news mattered to Janet as well as to me. Her brother Robert was with us, and when I wrote home, I carried his welfare across the miles along with my own. In a regiment made partly of neighbors and kin, one man's letter often bore more than one man's love. Hugh Reed was recovering, and that too belonged in the news. Another Edward, not myself, was well, but had not had the comfort of a recent home letter. I thought of that want because I knew how it felt. A man may be healthy, fed, and out of immediate danger, and still be poor in spirit for lack of a few lines from home. The soldiers' reading room at Baton Rouge gave us another kind of connection. Newspapers and small religious papers passed from there into camp, and sometimes from camp to home. I valued them not only for what they contained, but for what they allowed me to send. A soldier sending a paper to his family sends proof that he is thinking beyond his own ration and duty. He sends something that can be held, read aloud, saved, or passed to a neighbor. In that way, even printed words became part of the correspondence between Louisiana and Wisconsin. Such rooms and papers mattered because the army could narrow a man's mind if he let it. A soldier's world can shrink to rations, orders, weather, and the temper of the men nearest him. Reading opened the walls a little. It carried news of the country, reports from other armies, moral pieces, religious instruction, and the small printed matter that could be tucked into an envelope for home. I did not read as a scholar. I read as a man hungry for connection and meaning, and as one who wanted his household to have some part of what reached me. The papers also reminded me that words could travel farther than bodies. A sheet printed in one city might pass to Baton Rouge, then to my hand, then north to Wisconsin, then perhaps to another neighbor's table. The army moved by transport and road, but thought moved by paper. In a war so large that no man could see more than a small portion, paper gave shape to what lay beyond his own camp. So, the summer lengthened, morning washing at the river, drill when ordered, guard when posted, fatigue duty when assigned, heat rising toward the middle of the day, men under boughs, under canvas, under whatever shade they could contrive. rumors about staying, rumors about moving, news of Richmond, thoughts of Vicksburg, prisoners brought in from the uncertain country beyond the lines, letters opened, answered, folded, carried away, Sunday meetings, the farm entering camp by ink, the children entering the tent by name. The chapter of waiting is not empty because a man does not fight in it. It is full of what fighting interrupts. In battle, a man may not have room to think of whether the wheat is spoiled, whether the baby has been weaned, whether the children are learning scripture, whether his wife has walked home from the post office with no letter in her hand. In garrison, all these things return. The war does not grow smaller. It grows wider. It reaches from the guard line at Baton Rouge to the field in Wisconsin, from the river bath to the cradle, from the newspaper talk of Richmond to Janet's hands doing work I could not do for her. That was the long summer. It was not long only by the calendar. It was long because the mind crossed the same ground again and again. Morning brought duty. Midday brought heat. Evening brought some cooling and often more talk. Night brought the noises of camp settling and the river beyond. Then morning came again. In such repetition, a man may become careless or faithful. Carelessness says the day is nothing because it resembles yesterday. Faithfulness says the day is still given to him, and his duty in it remains. I thought often of the difference between being spared and being at rest. We had been spared in the retreat, and for that I was thankful. But rest was not the same as safety from immediate attack. Rest would have meant home, Janet near, children within call, work I understood from boyhood and manhood, a Sabbath with my own people, and the knowledge that no order would come in the night to put miles between us again. Baton Rouge gave us a pause. It did not give us home. By late July, the sameness began to loosen. Orders have a feel before they are fully known. Men sense movement in small signs, inspections that carry more purpose than usual, talk among officers, attention to equipment, the gathering of things that had been allowed to lie. The summer had taught us to wait, but no regiment waits forever. The river that had brought mail and newspapers and rumor would soon carry us toward another coast and another duty. We did not yet know the full shape of what was coming. We knew only that the long rest, if rest it could be called, was nearing its end. The shelters of boughs, the river mornings, the heavy afternoons, the letters read in shade, the prayers of Sunday, the farm managed by mail, all of it began to stand behind us as the next movement formed ahead. There was always a moment before movement when a camp seemed to look back at the men who had occupied it. The places where we had washed, sat, written, prayed, complained of heat, and watched for boats were only common places while we used them. Once orders gathered, they became memory. A soldier learns not to grow too fond of any arrangement, yet the body grows accustomed all the same. The path to the river, the patch of shade, the place where a man kept his few things, the neighbor whose voice he heard each morning, all of these made a temporary home. Then the army put its hand upon that home and folded it away. I had no wish to remain forever in Baton Rouge. No soldier, far from wife and children, could mistake garrison for home. Yet leaving it meant entering uncertainty again. The long summer had been hard in its own manner, but it had given us time to mend, write, wash, worship, and think. It had also given us time to remember what the war was taking from those who never wore the uniform. The next duty would ask something different. We did not yet know how much.
Looking back from the years that came after, the parts of soldiering that remain in memory are not always the loudest parts. A man remembers the firing, yes, and the marching when the road seemed to have no end, but he also remembers waiting under heat, washing in the river, listening for mail, hearing scripture in a camp where many men were too tired to stand straight, and wondering whether he would be ordered away before another letter could reach him. The war was made of those days also. They did not decide a battle, but they marked the men who lived them.
The army was readying itself again, and so were we.